You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Many things we once considered normal before the coronavirus pandemic could disappear in a post-pandemic world, whenever that might be. Last month, Dr. Anthony Fauci said this about the handshake, for example.
You don't ever shake anybody's hands. That's clear.
So in addition to more regular hand washing and the possible end of the handshake, we wanted to take a look on today's show at some of the other ways society might look different in the coming years, at both the individual level and when it comes to public life in general, on account of the coronavirus. To talk more about this, we're joined by Richard Sullivan, an associate professor of sociology at Illinois State University, and Suzanne Degas-White, chair and professor of counseling and counselor education at Northern Illinois University. Both of you, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
Professor Sullivan, I want to start with you. Dr. Fauci mentioned that the handshake could be no more. Do you think that the handshake could end with our generation?
I think not. I think that the handshake has got a long history, and it's survived other pandemics historically, and it is just so ingrained. I mean, I find myself even having to fight it now. We're early on in that, but I mean, if this goes on for years, maybe. But I think if it's, you know, 12 to 18 months, I don't think it will be enough to extinguish the handshake. We'll have alternate forms of greetings, I suppose, in the interim. But I think it'll be around. It'll come back.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a short-term change, perhaps, but there might be some other long-term changes from this, and things, you know, will go back gradually, perhaps. And I wonder, what are some of the other social norms you see changing in the long term, Professor Sullivan?
Well, some of the things I've been thinking about here as I'm observing this is that I think there may be more of a recognition of our shared interdependence, I guess. That's how I'd put it. The way that we rely on other people that we might not even know. I think that's becoming abundantly clear. We didn't really think about grocery store workers, for example, as being essential workers. Today we do. Truck drivers, likewise. These are, you know, segments of the population that don't really get a lot of prestige or status, and all of a sudden they're being elevated and asked to do some of our heavy lifting. I think that's. I'm hoping that will be one of the things that we see going forward. It's not just the people at the very top of the status pyramid, the people in charge that are getting the kudos and the recognition. I think it'll be a lot of these people in day-to-day jobs that we're seeing now are much more important than we realized.
Yeah. And Professor Degas-White, I wonder, what are some of the social norms that you envision changing in the months and years after the pandemic?
Well, I think part of what we're going to see, I appreciate the idea of the interdependence, and I think the recognition that essential jobs, who really is essential, I think we're revaluing that. And I think that we're also beginning to realize that as we move through life, we need that human connection every bit as much as we always have. But we realize, too, that we've got to be mindful of the ways in which our public health affects personal health. And what are the choices we're making that may influence the well-being of other people? So I think that interdependence, that connection to others, is actually growing stronger, because most of us, we exist in a society that is pretty much individualistic, that we really prize individual achievement. But I think the majority of adults now have realized that by ourselves, we're not going to thrive. And I think the kids today are also going to grow up and be changed by what they're seeing now, by what they're experiencing, and realizing also kind of the ways in which nothing in this world really is as guaranteed as we hope it can be, but that people come together to support one another. I think that's really going to be a strong lesson that if we're wise, we'll take with us, that we've all come together to help ensure the well-being of the least among us.
Interesting.
I think it's changing our own views. I think it could be, I said, from an individual society, we're not exactly as communal as many other nations might be. But I think this communal bent may be something, if we're lucky, that would stay with us here in the United States.
So I hear from both of you this idea of interdependence, maybe, and community, and sort of relooking at community? And I wonder, from, you know, from a big picture standpoint, Professor Sullivan, I'll turn back to you, on a societal or governmental level, is there anything else you're following as a sociologist?
Yeah, I mean, this is a good time to be a sociologist. I think that we are in this state of flux. And one of the things that I was able to impart on the students as we moved to online instruction at the end of this term was that, you know, we often don't see these things that are happening or that happen every day that we take for granted until we have these moments of crisis. And now we can't take anything for granted. Governmentally, socially, I mean, I think we're going to see this, you know, a recognition that, for one thing, I don't think we've had this sort of fixation on markets and the individual actions and individual firms being the sort of the driver of the society and the economy. I think we're going to see, at least I hope we do, we're going to see a return to this idea that markets by themselves are not going to solve some of these problems. It can't deliver healthcare in times of crisis like this. There are two different and competing models. And so, like we had in the Great Depression, coming out of the Great Depression, we had a realization that government played a role in maintaining a social safety net. And that, over the last, you know, 70, 80 years, that has, you know, evaporated. We've kind of gone away from the idea that we are all in this together and that we can rely on the government, our shared sort of collective body that protects the least among us. We've gone away from that. And I think we're going to see a reaffirmation of the sort of the collective effort, the need to look out for each other. And that if somebody doesn't have health care coverage and they're working some minimum wage job at a sandwich factory or a sandwich shop, their health could affect me if they don't have paid sick time, for mm-hmm. example, or health access to health care.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. We're talking about changing social norms and what is temporary, what might be permanent, and as well as just bigger, broader changes we might see in society. We're talking with Richard Sullivan, a professor of sociology at Illinois State University, and Suzanne Deggs-White, who is chair and professor of counseling and counselor education at Northern Illinois University. And as a reminder, you can always join the conversation. If you have a vision of what the new normal might be or what might change in the coming years, give us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. That's 21st Show. So we've been talking about the bigger changes. What about our personal relationships? We've only been allowed to interact with a very small number of people in person, those in our household. I wonder, Professor Deggs-White, do you have an idea of whether people may find friendships harder or that friendships could end after the pandemic?
Well, this experience has been unique for all of us to realize that how much we value social interaction, or for the introverts among us, how nice it's been not to have to interact face to face, but to be able to interact through social gatherings via online video calls, through cell phone, FaceTime, whatever it might be. But what I've realized talking to people, and people who have come from both ends of the extrovert-introvert spectrum, is the fact that they all can't wait to get back into the regular routine of social connections. They realize that we want to be with our friends, but they also have some concerns that we want to make sure our friends are making safe choices, and that we also have to respect some of our friends may be a lot more anxiety-prone than others as we go back and try to figure out what life is going to be like as lockdowns begin to ease. And I think it's that human perception of fear, human perception of threat, and that really does vary based on personality. And we're not going to be able to hold others. We should assume everyone's coming from a space of where they have to take care of themselves. And so we've got to be aware that some of our friends may be more ready to get together, even social distancing out in a park, than others, and to take and not to have expectations for how others are going to respond, because each of us are very much shaped by our own upbringing, by our own level of health. And if we're dealing with some of those underlying conditions that may be less visible to other people, we may come out with a lot more caution and fear of being within 12 feet of friends or being face to face in a closed space. And we've got to recognize that we can't let other people's fears hinder the connection and the relationship we have. And with introverts, some of them may want to stay relying a lot on video get-togethers and playing video games together, watch parties, whatever it might be, and that our individual personalities are going to influence how we come out of this. And we've got to recognize like the individual variations in our friends and support one another. And I think this is what this is about, is recognizing that some people may seem a little more anxious, and that's okay, because maybe they've experienced something that another person hasn't. Maybe they lost someone or they've been ill themselves, and they don't want to jump back in and risk their own health in order to make someone else feel better about themselves.
Yeah, I'm guessing that these conversations could be a little difficult and awkward to have, right? I know myself, yeah. I'm trying to picture sitting in my favorite restaurant, even if, you know, the booth next to us was empty and somebody was 6 feet over, that's going to make me pretty nervous to be in that situation.
Yeah. And other friends will be ready. I've got friends who live throughout Illinois, and some of them are, you know, going for walks with neighbors a few doors down that they haven't seen in 6 weeks. They said, "We miss being together. We're outside, we're walking." I said, "Are you wearing masks?" They say, "No." And I went, "This spot," you know, like we're all going to have what we think is safe and not safe. And we've got to make sure that however we're interacting in the world, that we're interacting in a way that makes us feel safe with our own choices. Because I think this, while we realize the total interconnection of all of us, and we're realizing, you know, there used to be saying the political, it still is a saying, the political is personal. Well, the public health is personal health. And so we've got to recognize, while I can't force another person to make choices I think are better for their health, I also don't have to risk exposing myself to another person's poor choices. A lot of people liken it to the no smoking areas. And it really is, you know, you've got the right to smoke, but you don't have the right to make me breathe secondhand smoke. Mm. You've got the right not to wear a mask, but you don't have the right to make me be within 6 feet of you or in your company if you choose not to wear a mask.
Yes, I would definitely like to sit in the no COVID section of the restaurant.
I would like, you know, wouldn't that be wonderful? We kind of joke about, you know, when I'm on video calls and things with colleagues or with people who've been diagnosed and have recovered from COVID, we kind of call it the COVID. Like, I don't want to get a case of the COVID. And what we're trying to do is minimize the fear we have, because I think the uncertainty about how each individual case of COVID goes makes us all fearful. So, you know, well, I know someone, you know, they're fine. They were sick a week and got up. You know other people that didn't live through this illness. And so I think it's the not knowing that really contributes to our anxiety. Our society, most of us do believe that 2 + 2 = 4, and we believe that gravity keeps the planets and the galaxy where everything needs to be. So we do have a tendency to assume logic and reason, and that there's a reason things happen and you can predict outcomes. But when it comes to COVID-19, none of us can predict what the outcome is going to be for any particular patient. Right. And that lack of certainty throws all of us off balance.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st. We've been speaking with Suzanne Deggs-White, Chair and Professor of Counseling at Northern Illinois University, and also Richard Sullivan, Professor of Sociology at Illinois State. You're welcome to join the conversation, 800-222-9455. Professor Sullivan, I want to take sort of a step back in our last few minutes of our conversation here. Are there examples from history we can draw on that might provide some perspective on how our society might change? I mean, you mentioned the New Deal era in the past. I think those of us who have parents or grandparents who lived through the Depression, you know that there was a certain frugality instilled in that generation. Do you see changes like that coming to people who are, you know, our age and younger now?
Yeah, I think this is a seminal moment for this generation. And a lot of this, you know, again, a lot of my students who are just coming of age right in this moment, it's like the world that they thought they were going to enter into, you know, in terms of work and careers and family life, that's called into question now. There's a lot of uncertainty. And Yes, I think that the level of frugality, you mentioned this, it's like, even in the few weeks, it's really not that been in the big scope of things. It hasn't been that long that we've been sheltering in place. We are learning new things. We're learning how to cut our own hair, for example. That's one of the things. Sew our own masks. I mean, I just had an experience. One of the masks that we were using in my family broke, and so I had to learn how to use a needle and thread. I think this is a new sort of era that we're going to enter into, and depending on how it plays out, will we have scarcity of certain commodities and services? We don't know. You know, there's going to be a real shakeup in the restaurant business, and how do we cook at home? We're cooking way more at home now, and we're relying less on delivery. We have all kinds of different ways that we're relying on ourselves more. In my neighborhood, people are planting gardens that never had gardens before. These are the sorts of things that we'll see. Whether or not that will, you know, persist, I think a lot of it depends on whether or not, you know, how long the pandemic itself and the sort of crisis moment of the pandemic lasts.
Just real briefly, in about 30 seconds, Professor Sullivan, I think if you look at the chart of deaths from the first half of the 20th century, I've heard Bill Gates talk about this. There's obvious spike of World War I and World War II, and then the Spanish flu in between. But until a few months ago, I would guess a lot of people didn't know about the Spanish flu, and it didn't really make it into the mass culture. I've heard Hemingway and Faulkner never wrote about it. And again, in about 15, 20 seconds, Professor Sullivan, do you see this pandemic leaving a mark in our culture?
Yes, I'm not an expert on the Spanish flu era, but I think that the impact that this is having on both economically and politically, we're in the midst of a presidential election year, and we're seeing the pandemic and the virus itself being politicized. Mm-hmm. And we have people, you know, the norms, you talked about the norms, people are, you know, the mask now becomes a political symbol. I think that's going to be harder to sweep this under the rug, and we're just beginning to see the devastation economically on people's lives. I think it's going to be tough.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Richard Sullivan, professor of sociology at Illinois State, and Suzanne Degas-White, chair and professor of counseling at Northern Illinois University. Thanks for being here, and more to come on the 21st in just a moment. Stay with us.